Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Friday, North Carolina once again made national headlines after the Republican-dominated General Assembly passed a series of laws stripping powers away from the newly elected Democratic Governor Roy Cooper. The two most significant bills involve the election system and the governor's right to make appointments. Here's some background. 2 weeks ago, North Carolina's Republican Governor Pat McCrory admitted defeat after alleging voter fraud for a month. The state's assembly then began debating Republican-sponsored laws to strip power from incoming Democratic Governor Roy Cooper and the state's progressive Supreme Court. On Friday, outgoing Republican Governor McCrory signed those bills. Before the vote, the newly elected Democratic Governor Roy Cooper said that to many, this might simply look like a power grab, but the move is more ominous. Here is Governor Roy Cooper talking about the consequences of this and what's to come in other Republican-dominated state legislatures.
And the General Assembly has put forth a number of proposed pieces of legislation over the last 12 to 24 hours. Most people might think that this is a partisan power grab, but it is really more ominous. It's really about hurting public education, working families, state employees, health care, and clean air and water.
And that is the newly elected Democratic Governor Roy Cooper responding to these bills. Governor Cooper said that he is going to sue, possibly sue. And now we are getting news that tomorrow a special session will be held to repeal House Bill 2, often referred to as the bathroom bill. Joining us with the latest on North Carolina are two guests. Mark Joseph Stern is a writer for Slate, where he covers the law and LGBTQ issues, and he's been extensively covering what's been happening in North Carolina, including videos of protests in a lot of his stories. And Mark joins us from New York. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Dr. Timothy Tyson, Senior Research Scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. Timothy Tyson specializes in culture, religion, and race associated with the civil rights movement. His current project, One Person, One Vote, chronicles the historic struggles for voting rights that youth converging with older community leaders fought for and won. Hi, Timothy. Welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you, Rose?
I'm good. Thank you for joining us. So let's start off by talking about what passed, because these laws are being referred to as a power grab. Timothy, can you tell us what these laws would actually do? Let's start off with the law that strips power away from the newly elected Democratic Governor Ray Cooper.
They try to constrain Roy Cooper's power in a number of different ways. The biggest one was probably to reduce the number of executive appointments that he would be empowered to make from 1,500 to about 300, which would prevent Cooper from building an effective administration. They also eliminated his authority to appoint members to the North Carolina County Boards of Elections. In other words, they keeping the entire electoral machinery in the extremist far-right hands. They blocked the power of the governor to appoint members to the state school board and to the University of North Carolina Board of Governors, which has been a major sort of conquest of the far right. They've taken over the university and are closing down all kinds of things over there. Another point is the Supreme Court, the North Carolina Supreme Court. We elected Mike Morgan, a distinguished African-American jurist, to the North Carolina Supreme Court, giving the court a one-vote Democratic majority. And other bills that were put through shift oversight of the legislature from the Supreme Court to the Republican-controlled Court of Appeals. They're trying, and there are a variety of things, to try to nullify Justice Morgan's vote. There's talk of a court packing plan that would add two more justices to the court and thus nullify Justice Morgan's vote entirely, but we're not it's not clear yet whether that's going through.
And all of this happened in the wee hours of the night. Reporters were not allowed in the chamber. Is that correct?
Well, not altogether. It wasn't all at night. Some of it was. The reporters were not barred from the chamber until everybody was barred from the chamber. But we were chanting and singing, so they were and sort of pointing out what they were doing. So,
Mark Stern,
they cleared the galleries.
Mark Stern, you've been writing about this extensively. Before we talk about how this happened, is there anything you want to add to help us understand what these bills would actually do?
Yeah, and there's one piece that I think it's really important for us to focus on so we can understand the context of these bills. And we mentioned election boards. So in North Carolina, every county has an election board, and the state has an election board that oversees those county boards. And the rule for a while has been that the county election boards have three members, two from the governor's party and one from the minority party, and the state election board has five members, three from the governor's party and two from another party. And so for a while, for the last 4 years, these election boards have been dominated by Republicans for the simple reason that Pat McCrory has been governor and he is a Republican. And so these election boards have been able to enact a lot of the voting restrictions that state legislature attempted to pass but that were struck down in court as unconstitutional and unlawful. So for instance, cutting back early voting, cutting back the number of precincts where people could vote, the number of hours during which people could cast a ballot, these kinds of things, which typically target or at least disproportionately affect black voters, were all instituted by Republican county boards. Now, when Roy Cooper was elected governor to succeed Pat McCrory, to really replace him, the hope and the law stated that these boards would flip Democrat. They would be two Democrats on every county board and one Republican, and three Democrats on the state board and two Republicans. And the Democrats would be able to reverse a lot of these curtailments of voting that Republicans had instituted. But the bills that have already been passed and signed, in fact, by McCrory, prevented this from happening and turned all of the boards into bipartisan boards with an equal number of Democrats and Republicans. And it gets better because the state board, even though it will have four Republicans and four Democrats, the law now states that a Democrat will chair the board in off years when there are typically no elections, but a Republican will chair the board in years when there are typically state and federal elections. So in my opinion, this is probably the biggest and most distressing reform, quote-unquote, that has been pushed through, and like you said, pushed through very rapidly. At one point, protesters and the media were cleared from the floor. One journalist was arrested. This was all done in just 72 hours. And this is the most disturbing part because it really does prevent Democrats from exercising what should have been their lawful ability to restore voting rights throughout the state.
Give us a little bit of the backstory here. What has happened over the past 2 weeks, Timothy? 2 weeks ago, the North Carolina Republican governor, Pat McCrory, admitted defeat. He was alleging voter fraud for an entire month. He wanted a recount in every county. But then once we learned that the Democrat, Governor Roy Cooper, incoming Democrat, got 10,000 more votes than the Republican governor, that all ended. So can you walk us through, you know, when did this all start, specifically these laws?
Oh, my. That's a bad question to ask a historian. When did this all start?
Let's just talk specifically about these laws, because I know that there's so much more going on in North Carolina, and we'll get to that later.
Well, but the thing... the thing to understand is that McCrory is the only incumbent governor Republican governor in the country who could not ride on the Trump tide. He lost the election. For about, as you said, for about a month, he was crying fraud. They filed complaints in 52 of the state's 100 counties for fraud. But two things happened. One is the plan there was to throw a lot of smoke over the legitimacy of the election, and then under a provision in the Constitution, the state legislature, which has a Republican supermajority, could declare the election contested, take it into the legislature, and reappoint McCrory governor. That was what they were up to. We put that out loud and clear so that everybody could see what they were doing. And then a funny thing also happened, which was that in the none of the Republican-controlled boards of election in any of the 100 counties would affirm McCrory's lie about fraud. None of his own people would support the allegation that there'd been any fraud or irregularities, and they could not, you know, they could not come up with any evidence. So they backed off of that, and McCrory was forced to concede his defeat. But this was, really a response to their loss, was to try to, as they often do, sort of, when they lose, they try to make a law against their losing, fundamentally.
Right.
Undo the results of the election by taking the powers that the voters, you know, intended for Governor-elect Cooper to have, and for Justice-elect Morgan to have, away, as a way of undoing the election, which is, you know, real typical of them, actually, over the past several years.
How did the public respond to the governor's refusal to concede?
There was a lot of confusion at first, I think, because the governor's campaign manager was saying things like, every day we find more and more hard evidence of voter fraud, and the head of the Republican Party in North Carolina was saying that, you know, someone is going to have to go to jail over this. You know, so they were acting like they had, you know, four aces and a pistol, you know, like it was just, and they had nothing, zip. They couldn't verify a single. So it became clear that they had nothing, and that also none of the Republican-controlled county boards would affirm any instance of voter fraud. And so the public, very quickly got angry, actually, and discussed it. I think it was a pretty bad hit.
Dr. Timothy Tyson is a senior research scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. We're also joined by Mark Joseph Stern, a writer for Slate, where he covers the law and LGBTQ issues. Today, we are talking about what is happening in North Carolina. This is getting national news, national headlines. 2 weeks ago, the Republican governor, Pat McCrory, admitted that he lost after alleging voter fraud for an entire month. The state's assembly then began debating Republican-sponsored laws to strip power from the incoming Democratic Governor Roy Cooper and the state's progressive Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court now has one vote Democratic majority. Now, last Friday, the outgoing Republican governor signed these bills. The incoming Democratic governor has threatened to sue. So that's where it's at right now. Some people are saying this is a legislative coup, and this is what's to come in Republican-controlled states under Donald Trump. So what questions do you have about what is happening in North Carolina? We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What do you think about this power grab? What does this say about U.S. democracy? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can tweet us. You can also leave a comment on our website. Now, Mark Stern, you mentioned voter fraud, voter suppression. I mean, and I wanted to ask you about a piece that Ari Berman wrote in The Nation called North Carolina's Legislative Coup Shows What Voter Suppression Will Look Like Under Trump. And he writes that Republicans have turned North Carolina, previously one of the most progressive states in the South, into a lab for voter suppression and offers a disturbing preview of what's to come under Trump. The legislative coup is merely the latest in a series of outrageous and illegal actions by the North Carolina GOP to undermine democracy in the state. Ari Berman writes that after taking power after the 2010 election, for the very first time since 1870, North Carolina Republicans gerrymandered legislative and congressional districts by resegregating the state politically in violation of the Voting Rights Act. What would you say about that?
Well, I think he's exactly right about gerrymandering, and it's pretty much impossible to deny that. In fact, a federal court recently ruled that North Carolina's districts are drawn in a way that discriminates on the basis of race and has ordered the legislature to redraw racially neutral maps and to hold new elections next year. Now, we'll see what the Supreme Court does with that, but we do have a very lengthy and serious and, I think, persuasive decision proving that Republicans gerrymandered the state based on race in a way that perpetuated their majority. You know, Democrats in the state are now clustered in just a few districts, so they're able to elect a few Democratic representatives, but Republican districts are spread out in a way that creates many more safe seats for Republicans and prevents there from being many competitive races. But an equally big problem is this issue of actual access to the ballots. And I need to provide a little context here. In 2013, the Supreme Court struck down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act, and a decision a lot of us probably remember. It was rather notorious at the time and has only gotten worse, I think, called Shelby County versus Holder. And what that decision did was prevent the federal government and the Justice Department from reviewing changes to voting laws that are passed in states with a history of voter discrimination. So North Carolina, of course, a state with a long, inglorious history of preventing black citizens from casting ballots. This was one of the states that had to have its voting laws reviewed by the federal government before they took effect. The Supreme Court took out that provision, invalidated it, and within days, the General Assembly, the legislature in North Carolina, requested data on voting based on race, an actual racial breakdown of voting preferences, and proceeded to pass a series of measures that basically eliminated those voting methods most preferred by African American and minority voters and created voter ID requirements that most heavily burdened minorities and African Americans. To quote the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in its decision striking down these laws, the legislature targeted African Americans with, quote, almost surgical precision. So, you know, this is a very blatant effort to curtail the votes of Democrats. The legislature believes correctly that black people are more likely to vote Democrat. Their solution to that is to disenfranchise black people. And so Ari Berman is exactly correct when he says this is what it looks like when Republicans launch a war on voting, and this is what it will look like over the next few years, because North Carolina was a laboratory, an experiment. This is about to play out on the federal level. The U.S. Congress is almost certainly going to entertain proposals a lot like the one that North Carolina passed. President Trump will be able to appoint judges and justices who uphold these laws. And so I think the reason why North Carolina needs to be a national story is that we are about to see this play out all across the country.
Mm. What are your thoughts about that, Timothy? In addition to what Mark said, Ari Berman reports that even after the courts restored a week of early voting in 2016, GOP-controlled county election boards in North Carolina limited early voting hours and polling locations. The executive director of the North Carolina Republican Party called on Republicans to, quote, make party line changes to early voting, end quote, that included opposing polling sites on college campuses, prohibiting early voting on Sundays when black churches held souls to the polls. The North Carolina GOP bragged before Election Day that African-American early voting is down 8.5% from this time in 2012, while Caucasian voters' early voting is up 22.5% from this time in 2012. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think that's a really good summary of what the Republicans have tried to do. One of the county chairs of the Republican Party actually was interviewed on Stephen Colbert and said, if this law if it hurts a bunch of blacks, that lazy blacks that just want the federal government to give them a handout, then so be it. You know, they were quite overt about the racial intent, which you have to underneath all of this, there's a racial politics that's really has to do with the coming demographics of the state. Latino and African American populations growing vis-a-vis the white electorate. And so they're sort of trying to cement themselves into power to hold off that incoming, what they see as an incoming tide of disadvantage for conservatives.
And Timothy, do you agree with Mark that this is what we can expect to see in other states?
Well, my yes, I do, actually. I think that North Carolina and Wisconsin are two states that seem to be bellwethers, that seem to be laboratories. Some of this has to do with the specific history of North Carolina and race politics in North Carolina going back through the collapse of Jim Crow, really. But it's also a national matter, because the demographics are moving in the same direction, and a lot of the tune is being called by big money, ideologically driven, Koch brothers, the American Legislative Exchange Council. A lot of these same laws are show up in other places almost verbatim. So it behooves the nation to really pay attention to what's going on in North Carolina, because, rest assured, it's coming.
I didn't realize that Republicans took power after the 2010 election for the first time since 1870. How have they been able to do so much in six short years?
Well, it's a little bit of a it's a little misleading to say that, really, because the Republican Party, we were a one-party state from 1900 until the 60s, really, late 60s. Politics took place within the Democratic Party. We had, liberal Democrats and we had conservative Democrats. Jesse Helms was a Democrat. Mm-hmm. Our most conservative Republicans used to be Democrats.
Right.
When the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act were passed in 1964 and 1965, then there's a huge shift of white conservatives pouring out of the Democratic Party as black voters are allowed to come in, really. And so that it makes more sense to say conservatives and progressives than Democrats and liberals, because Republicans of the 19th century were allied themselves with African Americans and pursued, public education and regulations on corporations and banks and public works and other things that we would think of as liberal. So it's not to say they haven't been in power since 1870 is really misleading. It's more a matter of conservative than the party titles just changed, really. The Democrats used to be the hard right, racial right.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll talk more about what we can expect from other Republican state legislatures by looking at North Carolina and why North Carolina is so important to learn more about. And if you have any questions or comments about what's happening in North Carolina, we'd love to hear from you. Dr. Timothy Tyson is Senior Research Scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, and Mark Joseph Stern is a writer for Slate, where he covers the law and LGBTQ issues. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion, or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll-free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about the potential Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. How will she change public education? For nearly 30 years, DeVos spent millions of dollars advocating for vouchers for private and religious schools. Over the past two decades, she reshaped Michigan's public school system. National reading and math rankings have fallen as charter schools have expanded and have been protected from regulations. So what changes can we expect under a DeVos and Trump administration to the country's education system? If you have a show idea or a guest idea, drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about what is happening in North Carolina. 2 weeks ago, North Carolina's Republican Governor Pat McCrory admitted defeat after alleging voter fraud for a month. The state's assembly then began debating Republican-sponsored laws to strip power from the incoming Democratic Governor Roy Cooper. And then on Friday, the outgoing Republican governor signed the bills. The incoming Democratic governor has threatened to sue. And we're getting the latest from Mark Joseph Stern, a writer for Slate, where he covers the law and LGBTQ issues. And Dr. Timothy Tyson is a senior research scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about what's happening in North Carolina and what this means for other Republican-controlled states, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Timothy, it is simplistic to say that, you know, things have changed so much in the past 5 years, but is it fair to say that in the past 5 years you've never seen so much extremism from the state's Republican Party? Because Eddie Glaude, chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton, wrote a piece in Time magazine saying that it's shocking what they've seen in the last 5 years in North Carolina. He said that Republicans transferred $90 million from public schools to voucher schools, cut pre-K for 30,000 children, repealed the earned tax credit for 900,000 people, banned gay marriage, signed HB2. He just goes on and on. The blocked municipalities from raising the minimum wage. Would you agree with that assessment, that you haven't seen this kind of extremism from the state's Republican Party?
We haven't seen this kind of extremism since the turn of the 20th century, honestly. But Obama won North Carolina in 2008, which is pivotal. And in 2010, we had a low turnout and the Tea Party takeover of the state legislature. That led to the racial because in 2010 was a census year. So that allowed the Republicans to racially gerrymander the state, because they got to redraw the districts. In 2012, that racial gerrymandering led to the election of a GOP supermajority so that they can pass anything they want to, and also of the election of Governor McCrory. And they began putting through this raft of far-right bills, which Professor Glaude mentioned, that they refused to expand Medicaid, denying 500,000 North Carolinians health care insurance. They slashed unemployment benefits sharply and did so in a way that actually prevented unemployed North Carolinians from getting federal unemployment emergency extension, which wouldn't have cost the state a dime. They repealed the earned income tax credit, which hurt 900,000 low-income families, and began a series of attacks on voting rights. So in 2013, we saw the North Carolina NAACP and its statewide allies started Moral Monday protests at the legislature. When McCrory came in 2012, he came in with 62% of the vote, including 25% of the state's Democrats voted for him. He ran as a kind of pro-business moderate. But as soon as he got in, he partnered with this Tea Party-nominated legislature and began putting through all this far-right legislation. But it went kind of quietly until spring when we started these demonstrations. He was running at 65% approval in the polls. After a month of the weekly demonstrations, he was down to 50%. By July, he was down to 40%. By September, he was running at 35% approval in the polls, 53% disapproved, and fully half of the voters in North Carolina said the state government was a national embarrassment. McCrory never, for the next 39 months, Governor McCrory's polls are underwater. From the fall of 2013 up until close to the recent election. The only thing that really gave him a chance against Democrat Roy Cooper was an incredibly well-timed hurricane, which let him put on a windbreaker and go around announcing things. So that helped him a bit, but he still lost. But all of that really begins with the uprising in 2013. Which is what you saw on television the other day when they started trying to take away the powers of the incoming governor. What you saw was that movement rising up again, and I expect the coming year to be very lively.
Hmm. And Mark, the Reverend William Barber said that if you want to know what a Donald Trump presidency will look like, all you have to do is look to North Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, it's bleak, but it seems about right. Here is a state where Republicans have abandoned all principles, where Republicans are no longer the party of small government, but the party of keeping transgender people out of bathrooms by checking their birth certificates, where nothing matters but power, and power must be maintained even at the expense of voting rights. It's a very bleak landscape down there, and there's a lot of really impressive opposition, namely the Moral Mondays protest and the protests that we've seen in the Capitol over the last few days. But I think that the comparison is spot on, and we saw how McCrory himself, who as was discussed, ran as a moderate, became this kind of bizarrely power-hungry guy who completely overran Democrats, didn't do anything bipartisan, caved to the extremist far right in his party, and now that the party is beginning to lose grasp on power, the Republicans are simply stripping power from Democrats, and the bills that they've passed completely reject principles of separation of powers that we've heard Republicans praise ever since a Democrat got into the White House in 2008. This notion that the legislative branch and the executive branch must be separate, each must have their own powers, one cannot encroach upon the other. You know, as a broad principle, that's considered a sort of American value. It should apply to states and to the federal government evenly. And yet here, as soon as North Carolinians elected a Democrat to sit in the executive branch, to control the executive branch, the legislature began stripping all of this power that was rightfully the governor's, that voters expected the governor to have when they voted him into office. office. All of those powers were taken away and given to the legislature. It was an aggrandizement of legislative power at the expense of the executive. That is a grotesque mishandling of authority in government. It is a complete infringement of separation of powers, but Republicans did it because they wanted more power and they figured they could grab it.
Speaking of power, we have a listener question. Many Democrats in Washington are regretting that they allowed the continued expansion of presidential powers during the Obama administration, powers which will now be handed to Donald Trump. If Democrats had the votes to limit Donald Trump's executive powers, wouldn't you want to see them do so, just as Republicans have in North Carolina?
Well, it's a good question. I think there's been a lot of Democratic hand-wringing over President Obama's alleged expansion of executive authority. I personally don't think that he's done much more than George W. Bush had done, and I don't think that if he hadn't done what he did, that a Republican who came into office after him would follow his example, follow his lead, and refuse to expand executive power. But look, the question is a good one. I think you have to recognize that at the federal level, the fight is more about clearly listed constitutional principles. What can the president do with his executive authority? What is Congress allowed to do? What is the sole province of the legislature? These can be sort of academic questions. But to give a sort of short answer, I don't think that Democrats should ever move to strip constitutional powers from the president. There are mechanisms in the Constitution for Congress to push back against what the president does, and I would hope that Democrats would use those lawful means and not do what's happened in North Carolina, which is to use essentially lawless means to go way beyond the normal democratic mechanisms and take away power that is rightfully the executive's, that is supposed to be for the executive, and give it to the legislature so that one party can maintain power.
And Timothy, how would you answer that question?
I don't. I think it's a, you know, it's a good question in its sort of broad principles. I don't think it's accurate, though, that Congress expanded Obama's executive authority. I don't think that there's anything for that Congress can now do to take away Trump's authority. The executive orders that Obama worked under are not; they can be undone by President-elect Trump when he gets in. But nothing's to prevent him from issuing similar executive orders of a different sort. So I think it's kind of a false comparison.
All right. Well, if you'd like to join us today, we're talking about what's happening in North Carolina. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. A couple weeks ago, North Carolina's Republican Governor Pat McCrory admitted defeat after alleging voter fraud for a month. The state's assembly then began debating Republican-sponsored laws to strip power from incoming Democratic Governor Roy Cooper and the state's Supreme Court, which now has a one vote Democratic majority. Last week, the outgoing Republican governor signed those bills. The newly elected Democratic governor says that he might sue. He's also going to hold a special session tomorrow to repeal HB 2, commonly known as the bathroom law. And again, if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I wanted to ask you about what's happening tomorrow, Mark. This is now getting a lot of coverage. The newly elected Democratic governor is going to hold a special session to repeal HB 2, the bathroom bill.
Well, actually, McCrory is the one with the power to call the special session, although the session appears to have been agreed upon between Cooper and McCrory. But yes, so tomorrow, during this time, the General Assembly will be meeting for yet another special session, this time to repeal HB 2, or at least that's what they've said. Last time they called a special session, it was to distribute hurricane funds, and suddenly they were passing bills to strip power from the governor. But they've said they want to repeal HB 2, which, as you said, is known as the bathroom bill, although it's really much more than that. It's a law that nullifies local non-discrimination ordinances for LGBTQ people across the state, in addition to excluding transgender people from using certain bathrooms, specifically government bathrooms, including those in school systems like the University of North Carolina. And HB2 actually came about in response to a very specific action, which was Charlotte, North Carolina, passing its own LGBTQ non-discrimination ordinance. This was last winter, early fall, early spring. Charlotte said, look, we're a modern city. We have lots of sexual diversity, gender diversity. We want to protect everyone. They passed a straightforward non-discrimination ordinance to protect transgender people, gay people, bisexual people. And McCrory and the state legislature went nuts. They said this is an outrageous bill. They alleged quite falsely that it would allow sexual predators to prey upon women and children in public bathrooms, and that is when they passed HB2. So what we've seen this week, all of a sudden, and rather unexpectedly, is Charlotte brokering a compromise with the General Assembly, apparently agreed upon, as I said, by Cooper and McCrory as well. Charlotte has already passed a bill repealing its own LGBTQ non-discrimination ordinance on the condition that the General Assembly repeals HB2. And this will leave us more or less where we started from. There will still be no LGBTQ non-discrimination protections in the state of North Carolina, but it does give a little bit of a benefit, I think, to progressives and to the LGBTQ rights movement, because the bathroom bill provision will no longer be in effect. The whole biological sex birth certificate requirement, this idea that you had to show your birth certificate to use a public bathroom, that will be gone. That will be out the window as soon as the legislature repeals HB2. So you can debate whether this compromise is worth it. I do think on some level Democrats did cave in Charlotte to the demands of the legislature. But at the end of the day, this does round up to a victory for transgender people.
And Timothy, what are your thoughts on how HB2, also known as the bathroom law, affected support for Republicans and the governor? Last March, this law was signed and it got international attention.
Yes. Ironically, McCrory it supported HB2 as a kind of in the hope that it would appeal to the base and get out the vote. It was really a cynical electoral maneuver. What happened was in the leadership of Equality North Carolina and the Human Rights Campaign and Southerners on New Ground and the North Carolina NAACP and its statewide network did a couple of things. One, we drove the support for HB2 down to 30% among voters. 30%. Not a very good electoral. So even McCrory's party included, HB2 ends up having the approval of 30% of North Carolina voters. Two, the enormous success of the corporate boycott, which cost North Carolina hundreds of millions of dollars in investment, particularly when college basketball is a religion in North Carolina, and the ACC tournament and the NCAA tournament both pulled out of the state. So those things were tremendously effective. In some ways, this is repealing HB2 is a good thing because it was very bad law, discriminating against LGBTQ and trans folk, and also it's important to remember that the HB2 it's not a very long law, and I don't know why people couldn't read the not so fine print, but it also forbids anyone, gay, straight, male, female, black, white, anyone, from using state courts to sue an employer for any kind of discrimination. It also kept local municipalities from increasing minimum wage, from protecting working conditions. Ironically, it in a bill that was put forward that said it was to protect children, the HB2 actually specifically forbade local ordinances from affecting workplace safety for children in the workplace. But anyway, there's all of this sort of, the people who HB2 hurt really adds up to damn near everybody if you read the fine print. It certainly did have a discriminatory intent against LGBTQ and trans people. That was the point, but that was also demagoguery, a lot of the business community initially supported it because of its protection against any kind of discrimination lawsuits in state court. So anyway, in the end, I think it's a good thing that it's repealed, but it kind of gets the Republicans off the hook. I mean, I'm for it, but it's a mixed bag. One, because Charlotte, had to back down on its ordinance, anti-discrimination ordinance, but also because it sort of lets everyone off the hook for what was ended up being a political catastrophe.
Timothy Tyson is Senior Research Scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, and Mark Joseph Stern is a writer for Slate. Let's hear from Terry in Palo Alto. Hi, Terry. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I find it very interesting to hear all of the informed comments about what's happening in North Carolina, even here in California. I do understand that it could harbor, things, signs of what's to come. And I'd like to know what can be done. I've also been listening to, what caused the repeal of HB2, and I'm wondering what forces can be marshaled to reverse what the governor and legislature in North Carolina have done most recently. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Terry. Timothy, do you want to take that first?
Sure. I think one thing to remember is that though, things are bleak in North Carolina in many respects, as across the country, in North Carolina we are mobilized in a way we have not seen in 60 years or so, if not before. So we've got I think the lesson in many ways of what has happened to Governor McCrory is, is to push back hard from day one, to be visible, to capture public attention no matter what you have to do it. You can't count on the media to tell the story. You have to sort of narrate your own story by making news in our own right, week after week after week. The More Monday movement in North Carolina forced sustained coverage of what was actually going on in Raleigh, and those things killed McCrory politically. For him to go from 65% approval in the polls to 35, and then to be the only Republican incumbent governor that could not ride on Donald Trump's coattails indicates to me that this was very effective. And it doesn't require a huge fortune. What it did require is some statewide coalition politics, stitching together progressive groups, about 200 of them from all across the state, into the same coalition, and agenda-driven, but not just transactional, but transformative, understanding that when one of us is injured, we're all injured. That the people who are enemies on the environment are also our enemies on LGBTQ equality. People who are our enemies on public education are also our enemies on healthcare. So we have to realize that we are all in this together, and work together, and organize, statewide coalitions that are aimed at the state governments.
And Mark, Mora Monday started back in 2013. As Timothy was saying, a wide range of people would meet every Monday. There were arrests. And after a while, it did start getting media attention. Reverend Barber recently wrote in The Nation that Mora Mondays can be an example of how people can stand up to Donald Trump's policies. Talk a little bit about your analysis of Mora Mondays and what people can learn from that.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that Mora Mondays was an incredible success, not just when you look at what it has produced, which is now a Democratic governor and a progressive state Supreme Court, but in what it thwarted. You know, the power grabs that we saw starting in 2010 and going through last week were an attempt to turn North Carolina into a solidly and perpetually red, conservative Republican state akin to Mississippi, where Democrats have essentially no voice in government and are locked out of the process altogether. And through Moral Mondays, this coalition of progressives were able to stop that from happening, to prevent a lot of the damage. Now we're seeing HB 2 repealed. Well, you know, like I said, there will be a progressive Supreme Court that may be able to reverse a lot of the dubious, unconstitutional bills that were passed by the legislature. And so the attempt by Republicans to take over the state is defeated. It's been completely thwarted. The legislature may still be Republican, but there should be special elections next year. You know, Moral Mondays is a big success story in effective protest and civic engagement. And so, you know, I think just going back to our caller's question, one of the reasons it worked so well was that it sparked an outcry all across the country. Everyone was tuned into this, from California to Maine to the Virgin Islands to Guam. This was just something that really grabbed the nation's attention. And that forced the legislature to stop working in the dark, in the dead of night. It made them realize that there was a spotlight upon them. And I think it limited what they were willing to try to do and what they were willing to try to get away with. You know, in the last month and a half, a lot of writers and political activists raised the alarm about McCrory stealing the election through the legislative coup that was described earlier. That ended up not happening. We've yet to see the court packing bill that was absolutely on the table just a month ago that would have let McCrory stack the state Supreme Court with more conservatives. So yes, look, North Carolina, it can be depressing. For liberals, it can be saddening to see that Republicans are pulling all of these power grabs and getting away with some of them. But it would be so much worse without all of the, I think, incredibly heroic work that Reverend Barber and others have been doing. So I think look to North Carolina as a partial success story. Progressives are not all the way there yet. But in terms of thwarting a Republican takeover and asserting Democratic values, activists have done a pretty good job.
Well, we will definitely keep our eye on what's happening in North Dakota. Mark Joseph Stern is a writer for Slate, where he covers the law and LGBTQ issues. Find his pieces about North Carolina at yourcallradio.org. Dr. Timothy Tyson is senior research scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. He specializes in culture, religion, and race associated with the civil rights movement. Mark and Timothy, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Martin.
Thank you. And coming up on tomorrow's Your Call, we'll be talking about Betsy DeVos. If she is confirmed as Education Secretary, what's at stake for public schools? For nearly 30 years, Betsy DeVos spent millions of dollars advocating for vouchers for private and religious schools. And over the past two decades, she's reshaped Michigan's public school system, where national reading and math rankings have fallen as charter schools have expanded and have been protected from regulations. So what changes should we expect under a Trump administration with Betsy DeVos as Education Secretary? Join us live at 10 a.m. here on Your Call. Support for the show comes from the listeners of KALW. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And today, our show was engineered by Kevin Vance. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks for listening.
Dear Donald Trump.
Dear Donald Trump.
Dear Donald Trump.
The day after inauguration, women's marches are planned all over the country to deliver a message to the new president. KALW and the East Bay Express want to hear what Bay Area women have to say. Share your thoughts at KALW.org/letters to Trump. What message do you have for the new administration? Head to KALW.org/letters to Trump.
In 2017, we're going to need strong, independent media, free of commercial influence. You make that possible at KALW. Please join us as we close our 75th year on the air in the Bay Area. Make your tax-deductible donation at KALW.org. And thank you. This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco. Reveal is next. It's 11 o'clock.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Almost every day, Donald Trump makes news by announcing some controversial pick for his administration, like this guy.
We are in an outright war against jihadist Islamic fascism.
His name is Steve Bannon. He's about to become Trump's chief strategist. He used to run Breitbart News, which he called the platform of the alt-right, drawing a lot of criticism.
It's white supremacy rebranded under a different name to make it politically palatable.
Playing to the worst divisiveness, the most prejudices, the worst racial divides to either try to get traffic or motivate people to support you. And I think that's despicable.
Decoding Steve Bannon on this episode of Reveal. But first, this news.